Hello, everybody, and welcome to our introductory class to our new series on Purim and Pesach and its messages for women. So I would like to start with the first idea that we're going to talk about in terms of something that we can practically apply to us from the messages of Purim. So we all know that before Purim comes the very important mitzvah of Mechiyas Amalek, and we know that women go out of their way to hear the parasha of Mechiyas Amalek. We make sure that our children are quiet, and we try to come out, whether it's during davening time or in the afternoon. And it's always something that women try to take very seriously. And yet, as you listen to those few lines of the story of Amalek and the need to destroy them and to wipe them out, we're left wondering, what is the practical message for us today? The Gemara in Yoma Nun Daled says that when Sancheriv Melech Ashur came, it says Bilbel Kol Haaretzos. Kvar Allah Sancheriv Melech Ashur uBilbel Kol Haaretzos, which means that really we don't really know who Amalek is today. The nations are mixed up, and you know we like to say that Nazi Germany was Amalek and this one was Amalek, but really technically we don't really know who Amalek is today. So when you think about this mitzvah that we as women go out of our way to be part of, you try to figure out what exactly are we talking about? What are we trying to destroy? And we realize that part of the need to destroy Amalek and to wipe them out is because of what they represented and what they did to the Jewish people in the past. And many, many of the Baalei Machshava and Baalei Mussar say that the practical application of Mechiyas Amalek, of destroying Amalek, is to figure out what Amalek represents and to try to destroy that in the world, to have the right hashkafos on things, and even to go as far as to destroy the Amalek, a piece of Amalek I might be carrying in my personality, I should try to wipe out that piece. So we will see different aspects of understanding this, but my goal really is that by the time you come to a shul for Parsha Zohar, for destroying Amalek, that you should have a clear picture in your personal life, and your personal avodah, what is it that I'm trying to destroy, and how can I really apply this to myself? Okay, so let's start. And this idea that I'm going to share with you today is really not even coming yet from Parsha Zohar, but it's coming from last week's Parsha, Parsha Yisro. And we know that in the beginning of Parsha Yisro, the Parsha tells us that Yisro heard, V'yishma Yisro, and Kohen Midyan Chasan Moshe, we know that Yisro heard, he was inspired by something that he heard about what Hashem had done for the Jewish people, and it was so inspiring to him that he decided to practically just pick up and go join the Jewish people with his family. And Rashi asks a question, which is really a question that is brought down in the Gemara in Zvachim Kufta Zayin, and in the Mechilta. The question is, what did Yisro hear? What was it that inspired him to do this action of just joining the Jewish people? And it's interesting because Rashi writes that Yisro heard that the combination of the things that inspired him was seeing Kriyas Yamsuf, was hearing about Kriyas Yamsuf, and the war with Amalek. So Amalek and Kriyas Yamsuf together are what caused Yisro to get up and join the Jewish people. Now, it's interesting because when you actually go and look in the sources of Chazal and the Gemara and in the Mechilta, they're really brought down as separate opinions. One opinion says that Yisro was inspired by Kriyas Yamsuf, by the splitting of the sea. And another opinion says that Yisro was inspired by Amalek, by the war with Amalek. There's actually a third opinion, which says Matan Torah, that the giving of the Torah, but Rashi does not bring that one down for the reason that of the order of the Torah. Rashi believes that Matan Torah came after Parshas Yisro. So Rashi does not bring down that opinion. But really what's interesting is that Rashi is taking two separate opinions that Chazal mentioned, meaning the Kriyas Yamsuf and Amalek, and he is combining them together. He's saying that what Yisro was inspired by was a combination of the sea splitting and the war with Amalek. So here we have an interesting question, and we want to look at this in a machshava-like way. What is this combination? What does it mean that Yisro was inspired? Why do you need both? Why couldn't you just say Kriyas Yamsuf was enough to make him join the Jewish people? Why do you have to say Kriyas Yamsuf and Amalek. And here we get to a very beautiful idea. And I'd like to quote here, this is an idea that I actually heard from one of my students, Yerulana Middleman, and a directorial that she gave, which was very inspiring and really made me think more deeply about this concept. She said that she was bringing down the opinions that we see, that really the combination of Kriyas Yamsef, of the splitting of the sea, and Amalek, comes to teach us something very, very important. When a person experiences something very monumental, like in Kriyas Yamsef was a very, very monumental event, you feel very inspired. But in order to really do something big like what Yisro did, which is to get up and join the Jewish people, you also have to be aware of the fact that even though you're very inspired right now, many people have been inspired by things and have done absolutely nothing about it. And Amalek is the paradigm of watching and experiencing something and completely, completely not doing anything about it. I want to share with you that there's a very, very interesting medrash that it's actually in the Mechilta in Parshas Beshalach, and it says that everybody experienced Kriyas Yamsef. The splitting of the sea was something that affected everybody personally. And the pasuk says, because when we learn about Kriyas Yamsef, it says v'yifku'u hamayim, that the water splits. And Mechilta says kol mayim shebe'olam nifku'u. All water in the whole world kind of splits at the time of Kriyas Yamsef. So you can imagine, we know Bnei Yisrael, you know, are walking, and Hashem splits the Yam for them. And at that given time, anybody who was drinking a cup of water anywhere in the world watched the water in their cup split. Anybody who was cooking something, or anybody who had like a container or a pitcher of water, all of a sudden the water in their container splits. And that's what the Mechilta says. Hamayim shebabarot, ushebasichin, ushebamaarot, ushebakos, ushebachavit, ushebatzlochit. You can imagine, or ushebakad, every form of water in any form of the world split at that time. So what does this mean? This means that all people in the entire world experienced the nes of Kriyas Yamsef. Now, we all know the famous Medrash in Tanhuma and Parshas Kitetze, which tells us that Amalek literally cooled off the whole world. And the whole world was inspired by Kriyas Yamsef. Everybody was afraid of the Jewish people after this unbelievable miracle that they actually saw and experienced in their own water, so they knew that it was going on. And they were all scared of Bnei Yisrael. If Hashem could do something like this for the Jewish people, they were scared to fight. Now, we all know the famous Medrash in Tanhuma that says that Bnei Yisrael, the situation was compared to a very hot bathtub where nobody wants to jump in. And Amalek jumped in and cooled off the water so that afterwards all the other nations can jump in. So we all know that Medrash about Amalek, which is based on the words Asher Kar Chabaderech, Kar Melashon Kar, cold, cooling off, that Amalek represents the cooling off of inspiration, the cooling off of fear. I would like to say that even though Amalek is the extreme paradigm of the cooling off of something very, very monumental, which should have an effect on you, and Amalek represents the cooling off of that monumental effect, we know that the other nations of the world maybe didn't do anything as extreme as Amalek. They didn't cool off the hot bath, and yet none of them thought to join the Jewish people the way Yisro did. So we see that Yisro was unusual in the sense that not only was he inspired by Kriyas Yamsef, and he didn't go to the extreme of cooling off, but he went to the other extreme. He said, this is such an important event, I'm going to join the Jewish people. But he needed to see Amalek to remind himself, to see that, you know, right now you are inspired by what you saw by Kriyas Yamsef. But look at what happens to most people in the world when they're inspired or when they see something very, very unusual. Most of them, on some level, cool off. They might not be as extreme as Amalek, who actively, with their, you know, chutzpah, cooled off the bath. And yet, we see the other nations, they didn't really do anything. I mean, they were scared of the Jewish people, but they didn't come to join the Jewish people. So we learned something very, very important from this. We learned that in order to be a Yisro, in order to be somebody who's affected by an event, you also have to be, you have to be very aware of two aspects. First of all, you have to be inspired and affected by the special thing that you experienced, and that's the Kriyas Yam Sof. And then you also have to be very, very aware that if you ignore it, if you don't do something about it, you will eventually cool off and not be affected by the event. You can be back to, the next day, back to business. Something wow happens, and some people hold the wow for a day, and some people hold the wow for a week, but eventually most people go back to business. And that's what watching Melchamas HaMalek, that's what Yisrael learned. He saw that a person can be inspired by something, a person can be affected by something, and yet in the continuum between Yisrael and HaMalek, people can have all kinds of levels of being disenthused or cooling off or forgetting what happened. And, of course, the extreme is a Malik who actually attacks Bnei Israel. Okay, so I want to bring this onto a practical level for us. And what we learn from this story of Yisro is that we need inspiration, but we also need awareness of the cooling off process. And that is what encourages us to actually pick ourselves up and do something when we are inspired. Now, if we go into this a little bit deeper, I think that as women, because we have a very strong emotional sense, and because we tend to see things and understand things in a deep way, there are many times that we're inspired to make a change, inspired to feel that something is going to affect us in a permanent way. This could be a positive event, like a nace that you experienced, a miracle that you experienced on a personal level or on some kind of bigger level. And when you experience it, you say, wow, this is going to be what we call a game changer. This is going to change things for me. I'm going to be different after this event. I would like to say that it's not always something as monumental as Kriyas Yam Sof. You know, we don't have that many. Hashem doesn't do Nisim Gluyim. But we all know of our own special events in our lives where something very important and special happens. And we're so full of inspiration and something like we're so moved. And we really at that time believe that this is going to affect us permanently. There are other types of things that sometimes affect us and inspire us, and sometimes, unfortunately, those are negative things. Sometimes there's an event which is so powerful in terms of its tragic proportions or its sadness that we say to ourselves, this is going to be a game changer. I will never forget this. I will never live this one down. I'm going to be a different person after this event. And here, too, we also have to be aware of the fact that whether it's a positive thing that inspired you or a sad, tragic thing that inspired you, the Amalek in us is that cooling off process. That though at the moment of inspiration, you truly believe that you will be a different person because of the event that you just experienced, there is a process of cooling off. And it happens even after the most monumental events. I have to share with you on a personal level things that happened recently to the Jewish people. I remember being very affected, if all of you can remember, the time that the terrible, tragic event that occurred around 3.5 years ago with Leiby Kletsky, Alav HaShalom, a beautiful, Tahar, little Jewish boy who was murdered in a very cruel way by another Jew, albeit not a healthy Jew, but a Jew. And I remember, as we all experienced the shock of that story in Bar Park, I remember thinking to myself, I think the Jewish people will never be the same after this. And I remember thinking to myself, like, life after Leiby Kletsky, what is it going to be like? And I had this picture that maybe we'll all just kind of put down our heads sadly, and we'll say enough cruelty, enough fighting, enough machlokas, enough strife, we'll make peace with each other. After such an event, after a Jew could cruelly murder a pure Jewish child, we as a Jewish people have to do tshuva, we have to change. And like everything else, immediately after the event, people were moved and people were thinking. But over time, unfortunately, we go back to life. Even after such big events, we have to now we like kind of dig into our memory to remember that event, and we remember it, and it brings back the emotion. But how many of us were permanently changed by an event like that? More recently, this past summer, we had the kidnapping of three Jewish boys. And the whole Jewish world for 18 days was very, very, very moved. And the unfortunate climax of that event. And again, at certain points, you say you feel things will be different after this. On a personal level, it'll be different. On a communal level, will be different. And yet, unfortunately, very often we just go back to life. Most recently, the terrible terrorist attack in Har-Nof, where four Kaddish people were killed. And again, there's a movement to action, and there's a feeling that we're going to be different after this. But we have to ask ourselves, that little bit of a malik in ourselves, how often are we just cooled off? We're moved for a certain amount of time, but are we really, really different in the long term, in the long run of our lives? Can we point back to those days, of those events, and say, that's what changed this me about me? Or since then, I took this thing upon myself, and it's been with me. And I think that there's something about us. Unfortunately, the three examples I just gave were negative ones. And positive things, people can be aware of different victories that the Jewish people have had, wars that we've survived, personal yeshuas, personal salvations that we've gone through, times that we were scared of something, and then it all turned out okay. And then we have to ask ourselves, did I permanently change as a result of that beautiful nace that Hashem did for me? I think that there's an antidote to this, because there's something about us that at the time of the inspiration, the emotion is so strong that we just kind of are convinced that the effect and the impact will never leave us. And yet we as women have to be sophisticated enough to understand our emotional psyche and to know that as much as I'm inspired, emotions don't last over time. They can't be maintained on a high level. They fluctuate. And the nature of an emotion, as strongly as you feel it one day, it could be that the next day or maybe a week later, it will start dying out. So what do we have to do? We have to be roa the nolad. As the Mishnah tells us, Ezu chacham roa the nolad. A smart person sees the future. He knows what's going to be in the future. Doesn't mean that you're a Navi, that you're a prophet, but it means that you understand the nature enough of a person to know what's going to be in the future. And we need to understand when we're inspired by something and we think this is going to be a real game changer for us, we have to be smart enough to see, is this emotional response going to be maintained over time or not? So what is the antidote? With Yisro, we learned that Yisro was not just inspired. He actually picks up his family and joins the Jewish people. There's no more permanent action than something like that. On a smaller level, we learn from the Igeret Ramban, at the end of the Ramban's letter, the Ramban writes, "Ukasher takum el sefer, techapes ba'asher lamadata, im yeshbo davar shetuchal lekaimo." The Ramban gives us very important advice. He says that when you pick your head up from the Sefer, from the book, you just learned an important idea. Look at what you learned and see if there's something permanent that you can apply and practice in action. And I would like to say that I think that this is the answer to this problem of a malik, of the cooling off that we have inside ourselves, even in the most inspired situations, is that we have to translate things to action. This is a little counterintuitive when you're very inspired by something to think to translate it right away to action. And yet if you want to have a permanent marker, some permanent effect, you must be able to translate. But to go from emotion to action, we have to go through a middle stage. And the middle stage is my intellect. Because my intellect has to plan carefully, what action am I going to take on? What change am I going to make? And here in my other Vadim and other topics, I've definitely mentioned this idea that Revolba mentions in Ali Shur. Revolba says that any skilled Baal Musar, somebody who wants to work on himself, has to know how to move something from emotion to intellect. Revolba brings an example. He says anybody skilled in any field knows that a discovery is made with emotion, and yet it has to be moved. The emotion, regesh, discovers something, but it's not really meant to deal with it. The secha, the intellect, has to actually deal with something. The example that Revolba brings is that you could have a very skilled surgeon, and he's doing some very, very important open-heart surgery, and he realizes that something is going a little wrong in the surgery. That is going to be an emotional discovery. Something is going wrong. And yet, if he's a skilled surgeon, within milliseconds, he moves that discovery over from the emotional realm to the intellect. What am I going to do to correct this problem? How am I going to fix it? If the discovery would stay in the realm of the emotion and the surgeon would sit down to have a good cry, chas v'shalom, what would happen to the patient on the surgical table? So anybody who's skilled knows how to take a discovery and move it from the area of emotion to the area of sechel, of intellect. The other example I like to bring is, you know, if you have a substitute teacher in a classroom and she suddenly realizes that she's losing control over the class, that's an emotional realization. Oh, no, this class is like, I'm not controlling this class well. And yet if she's smart, she will not show her emotion to the class, but she'll quickly say, okay, everybody open up your books, we have a quiz, or everybody, whatever she's going to do. And if the discovery stays in the realm of emotion, it's not very good for solving the problem. In fact, one of my children once came home and they said they had a teacher who started crying in the middle of the class when she was losing control over the classroom. That's obviously very damaging for students to see. So this ability to move over something from the realm of the emotion to the realm of the intellect is a very important skill that anybody skilled in their profession knows how to do. Emotion discovers something, but intellect deals with it. Similarly, Revolba says that in the world of Mustar, of Avoda, of work, emotion will often discover something, but Sechel, intellect, has to deal with it. And this is true about discovering a weakness, discovering a problem. But I'm going to say that this is true in the Yisro paradigm that we're dealing with it as well. To experience a nace as big as Kriyas Yamsuf is a very, very uplifting, moving emotional experience. And yet Yisro decides to pick up his family and move and join the Jewish people. So the discovery, the experience is an emotional one. It then is moved over to the intellect, and the intellect says, how am I going to integrate this experience into my life in a lasting way? Because if I just leave it in the realm of inspiration and emotion, I will not be a changed person. If I want this to stick with me, that in 20 years from now, I'll remember this emotional experience, it has to be switched from emotion to intellect and from intellect to action. The intellect has to pick an action that's doable and is going to leave a permanent effect. It often will not be something as big as what Yisro did, a big, big, big life change. For us, it might be something small that I could hold on to, like one of our Kabbalahs that we do around Yom Kippur time. It has to be something that I could integrate into my life and will always be as a result of that inspiration. I'd like to say that for us, as women, sometimes the inspirational moment will be not something as big as the Nisim that I described or even the tragic events that I described, but sometimes we as women, we have a very good smell about something being monumental or something being very, very important. And it might be a certain realization that we suddenly have this flash of inspiration of understanding one of our children or something that we understand about ourselves that's very, very, very monumental. We're good at this. We're good at smelling out things. And yet we're not always so good at figuring out how we're going to integrate this situation into our lives. Sometimes you have an interaction with a child that's unfortunately very, very negative. You may have passed a certain red line and did something or said something that you never wanted to do. and you're feeling very, very moved. And you're being a Yesira as the woman says, this is monumental. What happened today cannot happen again. This was very, very damaging. This is problematic. And yet, when you say to yourself, I'll never do this again, or I'm going to make a change in our relationship, or this is a sign that this relationship needs work, you're very moved at the time that you think that. But you have to think about whether tomorrow morning, when you wake up, it's going to be back to business. As we see, Amalek is only the extreme form of what the other nations did. They just were back to business. They didn't cool off the bath, but they also weren't like Israel. They didn't join the Jewish people. So this is us. We're very moved by something, and we say, wow, that was bad. This really, really needs some work, or I'm never going to do that again. And the next morning, it's back to business because our lives are busy, and they're hectic, and we get distracted, and we get cooled off. Not even in a conscious way. We just are cooled off. So if we have to sum up for today, really the message that we're learning from Amalek in its combination with Kriyas Yam Suf, and if we take Yisro as the paradigm of what we want to be like, whenever I am inspired by something, I have to realize, I have to be smart enough to understand that there's a concept of Amalek. Right now you're inspired. Right now you feel this is going to make a permanent change. But look, watch how in the past, and you know, the reality of life is that all situations that inspire us do not always lead to permanent change. And this is really the combined reason why Rashi quotes Mechamas Amalek and Kriyas Yam Suf. The two things together are what caused Yisro to pick up and do what he did. I'd like to just end with a story that I've mentioned before in some of my vodim, but I think it's worthy of saying it again, that I had a certain student who told me that she went on March of the Living with her father. March of the Living, I think everybody knows, is a trip to Eastern Europe where people visit the death camps, and it's a very, very moving trip of understanding the Horban that took place in Europe, the Holocaust. And the student of mine said that they had just visited one of the more famous death camps. I think it was Auschwitz, I'm not sure. And outside afterwards, they were sitting, and there was a kumzitz, people were sitting, singing. And the student of mine says to me, you know, she comes from a very non-Orthodox background, and she said that she's sitting with her father, and she's sitting and she's crying, and everybody in the crowd was sitting and crying. It was very, very moving after what they'd seen in the death camps. And she looks over to her father, and she sees that he's not very moved. And she was upset at him. She's saying to herself, if you're not brought to tears by what we just saw, then what would move you in life? She was very, very annoyed at him. And almost as if he understood her look, but maybe he didn't, I don't know. He turns to her and he whispers to her, I think I'm going to start davening shachris with a minyan. And she says to me, you know, my father never davened with a minyan his whole life. And he says, I think I'm going to start davening shachris with a minyan. I think I'm going to start. And she continued to be annoyed at him. She says, she's thinking to herself, what does this have to do with what we just experienced? We just saw the death camps. And she didn't understand. She was bothered that people around were very emotional and her father wasn't. So she tells me this story after, of course, you know, maybe it was a year or two after she had gone on this trip to Eastern Europe. And she says to me, you know, Mrs. Schoolmaker, at the time I was crying. And for the next few days, of course, while we were in Europe, I was very, very moved. Came back to America, and, you know, life goes on. She said, when I would open up my pictures from Eastern Europe, sometimes I'd be brought to tears. But you know what? Even that changed after a while. And now it's around 2 years later, and even when I look at my pictures, I'm not really so moved anymore by the whole event. She says, but I want to tell you something. My father's still davening shachris with a minyan every single day. She says, you know, he was so much smarter than me. I was very caught up in the emotion and the inspiration of where we were, what we had seen. But he understood that such an event should move somebody to a change. And when he whispered to me, I think I'm going to be davening. I'm going to start davening Shacharis with a minyan. She said, I didn't understand him. But now I understand very well that he was much smarter than me because of my emotions didn't really have a long-term effect on me, and they're not even so powerful anymore. But he's still davening Shacharis as a minyan, and he probably will for the rest of his life. And that's our message for today. Our message for today is that when something monumental takes place, to think about how you're going to translate it into something practical in your life that you could stick with. It doesn't have to be a Kabbalah that you will never, move from, but it has to be some kind of permanent change that will affect me, because I have to realize that inspiration has to be translated into something practice, or else it just gets cooled off. And that's the Amalek in us. It cools off even the most powerful of experiences. Okay, so thank you very much, everybody. And in our series, Amir Tashem, we will continue to take ideas from the Purim messages and from the Pesach messages and try to leave ourselves with applicable, practical messages that can affect us in a permanent way. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.